Good morning. Welcome to your turn. Mike Causey here. Glad you joined us. I hope you did not get snowed or iced out over the past week. We had an interesting one here in Washington. In fact, Tuesday, when the federal government was operating under reduced circumstances, I think it was the easiest weekday commute I have had ever. So I hope yours was good as well. Got an interesting show today. We're going to be talking about a variety of things, but again, we're always tracking the money. In this case, the new budget proposal between Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat of Washington, and Representative Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin. A very important deal was sealed last night by the four members of this budget committee, and now we're going to see if the Congress will accept it. And we've got some experts here that will talk about that, how it would work, what's coming next, a variety of other things, starting out with Jessica Clement. She is legislative director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Jesse, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I guess you had a busy couple of days, huh?
I had a nice snow day off and then a very, very busy evening last night.
Yeah, this broke at when, about 7 o'clock last night?
Yeah, right about 6:30.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us what's in it? I guess most importantly, what's not in it?
I guess let's start with the basics. The deal increases funding levels above the sequester and force levels in the Budget Control Act for 2014 and 2015. We are hopeful that this small increase in funding means federal employees will not be under the threat of furloughs and possibly RIFs in the next 2 years. So I think that is incredibly important, that the funding levels were raised above where the Budget Control Act levels would have placed them. Additionally, so you need to find a way to pay for this, right? So new federal workers, those who are hired beginning in January of next year, will pay an additional 1.3% towards their retirement. Now, remember, in January of this year, federal employees were paying an additional 2.3% into their retirement. So now we've set three different levels for FERS employees entering into the government. So hired before this year, 0.8%, or hired this year, 3.1%. Hired starting next year, you're putting 4.4% into your retirement without any corresponding benefits. And other federal employee issues in the bill, it also creates a self plus one category within the FEHBP. And related to federal employees, but not totally related, is a cap on contractor pay far beneath the current contractor cap.
Well, they also did something with the military, too, I believe. They won't be getting any cost of living adjustments before age 62 if they're retired on a non-disability retirement?
No, it's smaller military. It's smaller COLAs before the age of 62. So if you retire and you draw a military pension before the age of 62, you will get the COLA minus 1%.
Oh, so it's a diet COLA.
It's a smaller COLA based on what their belief is, that many of these people, because they can retire after 20 years of service, go on to have private sector employment.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things that intrigued me about this is we've been looking at this budget thing for years in some cases, but a variety of things happened. And I know the thing that you were quite concerned about that was at least on the table at some point, because the White House put it in their budget, is the so-called chained CPI. Mm-hmm. Has that gone away?
Oh, absolutely not. I wish I could sit here and say, yes, the chained CPI is not something we need to worry about anymore. But this deal is only for 2 years. And then 2 years from now, we're going to be fighting the sequestration level Budget Control Act funding, you know, for the remaining 7 years of the Budget Control Act. So this is a 10-year process. We are now, assuming, of course, this passes the House and Senate, we have a break for 2 years, but then we're going to be right back where we are today.
Well, it looks to me, I know nobody wants to crow about this because you don't want to make Congress think they did something wrong, but it looks to me like this is a great victory for that Federal Postal Coalition, that group of 30 organizations, including NARF, yours, but the AFGE, NTEU, federal managers, all of those groups. Oftentimes there's a lot of infighting and backbiting, understandably, between those, but they seem to have come together on this one.
We've come together together a lot over the last few years, starting with, you know, the great year federal employees had in 2009, which you like to talk about a lot. And we were very united on this front. Over the last several weeks, it came pretty clear to us that an increase in retirement contributions for current employees was on the table in this deal, probably around what the president proposed, which was 1.2%. And this is unacceptable to our groups. Federal employees have already contributed $113 billion towards deficit reduction. Members of Congress need to start having the tough decisions and stop taking the low-hanging fruit when it comes to budget discussions. And we put a lot of pressure on these committee members and the chairman, aided in part by our strongest supporters in Congress, Congressman Van Hollen, Minority Leader Hoyer, I'm sorry, Minority Whip Hoyer, and it's a bittersweet day because we were successful in the fact that current federal employees do not have to pay more for their retirement. So like you said, you know, this is a victory. But unfortunately, this continues a precedent that was set in February of last year in taking from future federal employees to, quite frankly, pay for bad policy decisions made in 2011.
Yeah, well, that's never stopped the politicians from doing that. One of the things that struck me as interesting was it was almost as if there was a political revival of this coalition, that unofficial but very effective coalition that operated when President Clinton came into office. You know, that was the first year of the Pay Act, and it was supposed to be automatic raises for federal workers over a period of 13 years, and to bring them close to parity with the private sector. It was a Republican president signed it. A Democratic Congress approved it. We thought all our problems were over with. And then when President Clinton came in, he said no raise. He proposed a zero raise. And at that point, Steny Hoyer carried the ball, and they sort of did an end run around their own president, got federal workers a raise. Later on, when the Republicans took control of the House, or when George Bush was president, people like Frank Wolf would take the ball and run with it and go around their own leadership to get federal workers a raise. And I noticed Congressman Wolf spoke out early, Mr. Hoyer did, Barbara Mikulski, Ben Cardin, Jerry Conley in Virginia, but it was a bipartisan effort, and it obviously seems to have worked.
Absolutely. Congressman Wolf did, in fact, send a letter to the committee asking them, you know, to leave federal employees out of any non-balanced deal, which, of course, this one wasn't. There wasn't any discussion of entitlement programs or, you know, very little talks on the mandatory spending side of things. In that sense, we were successful. But Congress just decided in February of last year to raise retirement contributions for new hires. And now they're doing it again. In 2 years from now, are we back here fighting that same fight that we did? You know, you can't keep taking away from future federal employees. And, you know, all signs point to yes.
But, you know, that, to look on the bright side, that gives you 2 years to probably to regroup and strengthen some of your alliances. I think what everybody needs, NARF and all of the federal unions, is more members.
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you for that.
The secret is how to get them.
Yes, please consider joining the association that serves your needs the best.
Yeah, well, you know, talking about retirements, NARF, you're active and retired people, but we see that retirements from the federal government were down in November, and also the OPM processing level was below what it had anticipated. Do you know what's going on there?
I don't. I'm not the expert on that issue in my office, and quite frankly, our time has been taken up by other pressing issues on the Hill these days, but I can certainly get your readers and your listeners an answer to that.
Okay, and there may not be an answer. It could be that December and January tend to be the big months for retirement, and it could just be that instead of retiring in November, people are looking for the best dates, which would be December 31st for some and January 3rd or January 11th for others.
Yes, typically December, January, and February seem to be the months where the most people retire. That doesn't necessarily mean those are the best months for everybody, of course, but Those typically are the months where the most federal employees retire over the course of the year.
Right. I did a column, in fact, this week, and I can brag about it because Tammy Flanagan supplied most of the information. she's the expert. But there are, and without getting too zen-like, there are a number of best dates to retire, as you said, throughout the year, depending on when you retire. There is only really one best day, and that is the day when all of the stars align and come together and you've made peace at the office and at home and decided to go. But it is I recommend that people take a look at that. It's based on information from Tammy Flanagan. And again, there are a lot of best dates, but only one best day. Take a short break here. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Jessica Clement. She is Legislative Director of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Before that, she worked for the Federal Managers Association in a similar job, and before that, she worked on Capitol Hill as a legislative assistant and knows the way the system works there, has been there, done that, got the T-shirt, as they say. Jesse, we appear to have bought 2 years of possible peace here if the House and Senate go along with it. What do you think are the chances that they will go along with this Ryan Murray compromise?
I think the chances are pretty good that this bill is going to make its way through the House this week and the Senate next. You're going to lose members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. You're going to have Republicans who will not accept any spending package that has a higher level of spending than the Budget Control Act, than, you know, the level set forth with sequestration. So you're going to lose, Paul Ryan's going to lose some folks on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, there is a lot of discontent over the fact that the bill did not include an extension of unemployment insurance. So you'll probably lose some of your more progressive Democrats who will vote against this deal because it does not include that extension. But I think overall this deal is likely to pass both chambers in the next week.
You know, my guess, and it's purely that based on nothing but just sort of if the past is prologue, is that both sides, both the extreme conservatives and the extreme liberals, or the Tea Party and the progressives, they're going to first count heads to make sure this thing will pass. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to decide who they're going to allow to vote against it to shore up their constituency.
Right. And I mean, Congressman Ryan made it very clear during the press conference that they held last night that this bill is supported by House leadership and in saying that pretty much guarantees this will make its way through the House.
Yeah, that's right. He's the guy on this. I think whoever selected this committee, this joint House-Senate committee, wanted it to work. He had a couple of friends of federal workers on there. Chris Van Hollen was on the committee, wasn't he?
He was.
Okay. And then you had that, Patty Murray. So, and then you have Paul Ryan to give it credibility with the fiscal conservatives. So it's looking good. I keep going back. To me, the headline for this, the takeaway, is what didn't happen, and that is the higher contributions for current employees, which both the Republican budget called for. They called for quite high increases, and President Obama's budget called for, I think, a 1.2% increase.
For current employees, yes.
Right.
I mean, that's budget. And Paul Ryan's budget called for a 5.5% increase for current employees. So, you know, if you're looking at it from his standpoint, this was a big concession on his part.
Yeah, it's tremendous. And I've heard some reporting, too, which talks about the fact that federal workers are taking a pay cut because of this. But current federal workers will not be taking a pay cut because of this.
They will not. Under this provision, it would only affect people who are hired beginning next year and thereafter.
Right.
But,
and,
you know, that is to say, too, this is me worried for the future because not only is this now a precedent, but FERS employees are now going to pay 4.4%. Paul Ryan wants that number to be 5.5%. So when we're back here having the same conversation 2 years from now, are they going to be asking new hires for another increase?
Very likely that will happen. The other thing that didn't happen that was definitely out there because it was in the president's budget. Correct me if I'm wrong, and that is the chained CPI.
Yes, the chained CPI was in fact in the president's budget. It was part of the Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Commission recommendations. So we believe this is going to continue to be on the table until it, of course, is no longer on the table. And I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Well, and this one, too, from the other side, I know your group says it's unfair because it would cost, I believe you said over 30 years, it would cost a typical retiree, there would be a loss of something like $38,000 in benefits.
For your average CSRS retiree, which right now most federal retirees are CSRS retirees, with the average CSRS pension, these retirees would lose $48,000 over a 25-year period, and that's inflation-adjusted dollars. This is real dollars we're talking about, $48,000 under the chain CPI. One of the reasons for that is because it's compounding in nature. So if you get a smaller increase in 1 year, you know, the increase on top of that is going to be smaller the next and smaller the next. So the longer you live, the more of an impact this is going to have on your pension.
Okay. And the other thing, too, the people who want this, and there are many, including the White House wanted it, is not so much to get at federal workers, it appears, but to get at Social Security, which is the big one.
Yes, you're going to get some savings from the federal workforce on this. Same with military if you implement this for military retirees. But your biggest savings in this proposal will come from Social Security recipients. So depending on, of course, how Congress chose to implement this, if they choose to implement this, would determine the impact on, you know, your various constituencies.
Yeah, well, I think you're very right here that the precedent has been set because, you know, people have attacked their federal retirement plan for ever since it was begun, but they've never made any inroads. They did change, they switched the old civil service system, and they put new hires under the federal employees retirement system, which is still excellent and very good, but they haven't been able to hit it until this time around.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's next? What wakes you up at 3 a.m?
What's next is, well, I'm hoping, as I told your colleague Francis Rose yesterday, I am hoping this means for once all of us can have a pleasant New Year's Eve and don't have to spend our New Year's Day tethered to our computers making phone calls and working like we did this year. So provided Congress leaves town, you know, the House is set to adjourn on Friday, the Senate the following week, you know, maybe we can have a quiet holiday period, but then these things are going to keep coming up because we still have sequestration on the table. We still have members of Congress who believe the federal employees should be giving more than less. Like, it's a nice break in the fight, but it's certainly not the end of the fight.
Well, I wonder, too, if members of Congress haven't taken a look at the polls and seen how much this government shutdown hurt them. It hurt the White House some, but it really put Congress at an all-time low, and I would think that those who are looking to a re-election in 2014 or want to help with maintain the Senate for the Democrats or take it away for the Republicans would be looking at this and saying, you know, shutdowns are not a good idea, and particularly when you shut down the government, reduce all those services, and then wind up paying the people for being forced to stay home.
Yep, I think members of Congress are acutely aware of what the shutdown did to their approval ratings. One party was hit worse than the other. This deal, of course, avoids now another government shutdown for 2 years, and I think that was high on the minds of these lawmakers to ensure that they didn't go through this again because it was a losing PR battle for them.
Very good. Jesse Clement, thank you very much for being on. We'll be talking to you later on. We'll take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com. 1500 AM, Lauren Larson and I will be right back. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Glad to have you with us. And a reminder that we're here every Wednesday at 10 AM. And our shows are archived on our homepage. This includes past shows as well. So if you ever need to listen or want to pass it on to a friend, that's the way to do it. My next guests are Sean Riley and Andy Medici, writers for the Federal Times. Gentlemen, you there?
Yeah, how you doing, Mike?
Good. How was your commute today?
No problem at all.
Okay, the car kept fogging up from the inside, literally ice crystals. It was cold out there. But we made it.
But the roads were clear.
Yeah, the roads were clear. Yeah, it was a good thing. Listen, a funny thing happened on the way to the end of the world. And that is the budget agreement was is done at least at the preliminary stage. Were you surprised?
I am that I was certainly expected to come a little later in the week. Typically, these things, at least in the last couple of years, tend to get worked out in a half hour or so before midnight. This one came 3 days before the House is set to adjourn for the year, so it was a pleasant surprise.
You think maybe, I was talking with Jessica Clement earlier, that maybe the sort of black eye that Congress got because of the government shutdown might have put the fear of the voters in their works here?
Possibly. I think just fear for Congress's overall reputation and the growing consensus that it's unable to get anything of any substance done. I think that was certainly a factor in their desire to come up with an agreement that will, if it's approved by Congress, signed by President Obama, would provide some stability through the end of budget stability through the end of fiscal 2015.
My theory, which is worth paper it's written on and not much else, is that this is one of those legislative deals that they're going to go around and carefully do a head count to make sure they have enough people in the House and enough people in the Senate to pass it, and then they will give certain people, some conservatives and some liberals, a pass to vote against it just to satisfy their constituency. You think that's a likely scenario?
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, my guess would be just out of prudence, they already would have done at least a tentative head count to make sure that they do, based at least on the outline of the agreement, that they would be able to get enough support to pass it. It would be obviously a huge humiliation for leadership in both houses if they were unable to get it through. And I think probably, their chances are pretty good that some Republicans in the House of, the Tea Party variety will probably vote against it. However, and with, with the tacit permission of the leadership, assuming that they can get enough Democratic votes to push it over the finish line.
Yeah, this seems to be the way it winds up in the end, and it has whoever picked this committee, the leadership of the Senate and the House, chose wisely, because you had Ryan, who is the obvious leader of the tough budget people. You have Chris Von Hollen, who is knowledgeable on budget matters and leader in the House as well. So it was a good choice. Some other things coming down the road. Jessica Clement is worried about the next 2 years, even though there is, agreement so far that there's probably not going to be any shutdown. There's probably not going to be any furloughs, but she's still worried about the next 2 years. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, again, assuming this agreement passes, it will provide some relief from, sequestration that's, the next round is supposed to, probably hit next month. And also the round in 2015, this would provide some relief for both years, more in 2014 than 2015. But, we've got to remember this is these are reductions that there are still going to be some reductions. And I think agencies, as of this morning, are probably still trying to figure out what this agreement will mean for them. I think the benefits are clear for the Defense Department. It would significantly reduce, some of the hit they would take, the hit they would otherwise take. And there would be an equal amount of sequester relief for the rest of the rest of the government, the civilian agencies. But how that apportions out between different agencies is harder to tell. It's still going to be a very constrained budget environment. I don't think there's any question about that.
Well, I know the Defense Department earlier, and I think under Secretary Hagel, it's not right to use the word threat, because when Defense has said it, at least under his leadership, they meant it at the time. But there was talk of layoffs in defense, and then the Association of FBI Agents at one stage of the game was talking about major furloughs in the Justice Department. So I would think this agreement, once they shake it out and do their accounting magic and whatnot, would probably eliminate the possibility of furloughs or layoffs.
We'll have to see. You've got to remember also, 1% federal pay across the board pay raise for federal employees that has not been budgeted, as far as I know, is scheduled to take effect in January, and that's welcome news for federal workers, of course. But it is money that may not that agencies will have to find from some other way, from some other source. To pay for. And with regard to the FBI, I mean, the FBI management had, I think, privately acknowledged that they were looking as up to as many as 10 furlough days for pretty much the entire FBI's workforce. So the question is whether this money, assuming that was a reasonable estimate, if that was, that wasn't just a scare tactic, You know, remains to be seen exactly how much additional funding this agreement would free up, how they would choose to allocate that.
Yeah, that's the traditional Washington Monument cut. Congress decides to cut a program, and so the Interior Department denies access to the Washington Monument and other national parks, which they did this year along with a little help from the earthquake we had. But but that tended to backfire on the Congress, which is, I guess, the point of it all.
Well, you got to be careful. I mean, what we saw in FY13, fiscal 2013 with this question, you'll recall the Defense Department originally had talked about furloughing employees for 22 days, and the final total turned out to be 6, and they were able to, you know, they got some they got approval from Congress to move some money around. I'm sure there was, you know, there was some basically some fat in there that they were able to take advantage of. But a liberal think tank recently came out with a study saying that, you know, a sequester in fiscal 2014 this year would be the impact would be more severe just because some of those gimmicks wouldn't necessarily be available. That, you know, a lot of the fat had already been cut.
They've used up their magic tricks. Well, I remember early on in the talk about the furloughs that a high Navy official said, actually, we don't have to do it. We're in good shape. And there, he was called to the woodshed and came back and said, oops, I made a mistake. My calculating was bad. We're going to have to do it as well. So always a lot of politics going with this.
Well, Mike, if I could step in for a second. I think you're right. I think what we see a lot of the times is general support for cutting government spending in the abstract. But when it gets to specific programs that people like, that they enjoy, that they want, or that they feel are vital, then we start seeing resistance. And that's the case with a lot of the programs that we saw during sequestration and during these budget showdowns, is these once you cut to specifics, there's a lot less support for some of these cuts.
It's the reverse of the not in my backyard syndrome, isn't it? I want you to cut out all the fat in government except the programs that I like on the national parks that I go to. I thought of this when the FBI was talking about furlough days in this coming year. Because, you know, at the time of heightened tension, threat of terrorism, worries about crime, furloughing the FBI does not seem like a good political move.
No, I don't think so. I think, I think people are very sensitive to security. I think people are very sensitive to the needs of law enforcement. And I think sometimes what people need is they need agencies to put a specific forward about what the cut would mean. Because in the abstract, government spending, reducing government spending, a lot of people do support. But if it translates into, for example, fewer law enforcement officers on the street, fewer counterterrorism investigations, I think that's when people really step back and say, well, maybe we need to revisit some of these cuts.
A while back, the Postal Service proposed, not for the first time, that they eliminate Saturday delivery. And that, as I think most people figured would happen, was shot down by particularly members of the House who like having local post offices and they like having Saturday delivery. Some people do. Now there's some talk about the Postal Service and Amazon doing deliveries on the weekends.
Oh, I think that's already, it's not talk, it's already been done.
Is it a done deal?
On Sunday, yeah. But, I mean, this is underscores, you know, the fact that the Postal Service's package business, contrary to first-class mail volumes, has been rising considerably. It's one reason why the Postal Service, you know, turned in, relatively speaking, a much better financial performance in fiscal 2013 than was expected. You know, they had originally thought they would lose $7.6 billion, and instead they lost a relatively modest $5 billion. And a big part of the reason was because their package business is doing so well, and they are, you know, I think they've astutely capitalized on that in this agreement with Amazon.
Yeah. Well, now, with the Postal Service, at one point they were proposing setting up their own health plan, and we're looking at retirement matters. Where does that stand, or is that going with the wind?
I wouldn't call it gone with the wind. It's definitely in some dark corner of limbo. You know, they're still pursuing it, and I think, you know, their main concern is dealing, I believe, with the retiree population, you know, basically to make Medicare the cover, you know, the insurer essentially of first resort rather than the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. Because that's where most of their expenses come from, and of course, you know, retirees tend to be older, you know, have more illness, etc. I don't think you're going to see any action on that this year. Coincidentally, just before we came into the booth here, I got an email, and I have to stress this is unconfirmed, but that the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee will hold a markup on its version of postal legislation next Thursday. Now, that's going to be too late, you know, presumably they wouldn't have done this unless they thought it was ready to pass. They've canceled two previously scheduled markups, apparently because there just wasn't enough consensus on how to go forward. But this would potentially set the stage for some sort of action by the Senate next year, although, of course, we'll be an election year, and that makes it tough to deal with anything of any substance. But anyway, it does seem like they might be making some progress there, and there is the possibility under that bill, at least it was originally proposed, that the Postal Service would get the go-ahead to begin negotiating with unions on creating some sort of standalone health plan, either within the confines of the Federal Employees Health Benefits Programs or apart from it.
Yeah. Again, I've talked to people who are very knowledgeable of the insurance business, and they say the only way they think the Postal Service could offer at least equal benefits and keep the premiums is if they would somehow jettison the retirees.
Well, I don't know the numbers on that, but I think it would probably be it seems to be their primary concern, and I think they're willing to accept leaving the active workforce within the FHBP essentially under the status quo if they can get some relief for the retirees, and also from this requirement that they contribute about $5.5 billion every year into a fund for future retiree health care.
Yeah, well, that's how private sector health programs always satisfy things, is when people hit 65 or retired, they either cut them off, reduce their benefits, or increase their premiums. Because the retirees need the younger people in there. Of course, that's kind of at the heart of Obamacare here, is to entice us millions and millions of young people who are now not insured and are, for the most part, very healthy, to get them into the insurance risk pool and the premium pool.
Yeah, well, the Postal Service, its career workforce, tends to lean on the older side.
Yeah.
And so what the Postal Service wants to do is really sort of do some cost shifting here. I mean, the government would still be paying for these retirees' health care through Medicare, but it wouldn't show up on the Postal Service's books.
Yeah, well, and, you know, but a lot of people don't think about it. We have the jokes about dogs biting a letter carrier, which, in fact, is no joke. They have thousands of them each year. But it is a very dangerous place to work. We had a postal carrier killed here in the Washington area recently. Maybe a robbery, who knows. But these are industrial-type jobs. They're on the road, many of them, and vehicles driving, you know, right-hand drive vehicles. So it's a very dangerous place to work, so not necessarily good insurance risks.
Yeah, I think some people forget that not all, you know, that a lot of government jobs are, you know, they have inherent danger to them, or you're out. Every day, you know, in possibly dangerous situations. And we've run stories about, you know, the Postal Service in particular is one of the top agencies where people suffer from, you know, fatal injuries while on the job. And that's something that I think, you know, people need to be aware of when we're talking about health insurance benefits. It's not just, run-of-the-mill issues and health problems, but it could also be really serious issues that occur while on the job.
I want to take a break here, but when we come back, talk about some dangerous jobs in the government. FederalNewsRadio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey. I'm talking with Sean Riley and Andy Medici from the Federal Times, and we were discussing dangerous federal jobs. I'm just making a list of them here during the breaks, and think of that IRS employee that was killed in Austin, Texas a few years back when a disgruntled taxpayer, to put it mildly, rented or stole a private airplane and crashed it into the building in Austin. We had the shootings here at the Navy Yard recently. Postal worker that was killed in suburban Maryland right out of D.C., federal agents that put their life on the line every day, Border Patrol people. Being a diplomat is a very dangerous job. I recently went through a mock safe room for an ambassador, and it showed that most of our U.S. embassies have these, and this is a place where the ambassador and family and immediate staff go and lock themselves in and wait for the Rangers or the SEALs to rescue them. Meat inspectors in the Agriculture Department sometimes are threatened on an almost daily basis. They go in and maybe threaten to shut down somebody's business, and you're talking about their livelihood. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I definitely think that these are one of those situations where, you know, the public, when they think of government, it's hard for them to sort of separate the jobs in there. But, you know, the federal government has a lot of jobs that deal with dangerous people or in dangerous situations or in dangerous environments, you know, whether, you know, as you said, you know, diplomats or postal workers or, you know, firefighters. There's a whole host of jobs that government employees do that put them in dangerous situations. And, you know, we've covered this in the past, you know, that there, you know, even in 2012, you know, not counting 2013, you know, 54 federal employees were killed on the job. And that's just in the United States. That doesn't count anything overseas. And, you know, these impacts are, you know, widely felt throughout all the communities that they serve. And I think people need to remember that there are a lot of federal jobs that are inherently dangerous.
Well, Time magazine gave me a hard time about it years ago, but when I wrote something and I said that the first man on the moon was a GS-14, and they took it as a symbol of my parochialism, but in fact it was Neil Armstrong, and although he had been a test pilot, he was a civilian employee of NASA, and that's pretty tricky work.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we forget that, you know, some of the most popular programs, they're federal employees, and, you know, they're doing cutting-edge work, and that could be dangerous, you know, whether it's, you know, being a test, you know, whether it's being a test pilot in the military or whether it's being a civilian employee and, you know, going up in a space shuttle that, you know, had only been, you know, worked on for, you know, 8 or 9 years in the NASA program.
Yeah, some very interesting, very dangerous jobs in the government. We've covered this and you've covered this, but what's the deal between the Senior Executives Association and the Defense Department? This is the largest federal agency, and SEA is unhappy about what?
Well, late last month, DOD announced its policy for performance awards, you know, for essentially performance bonuses for members, career members of the senior executive service at DOD, and then also what are called senior professionals, which in my understanding is essentially scientists, engineers, et cetera. And in the memo, DOD said that the pool, this is for fiscal 2013 bonuses, that the pool would be 1% of the aggregate salaries of those employees, you know, in that category. And a couple days ago, the head of SEA, Senior Executive Association, Carol Bonacero, wrote to Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, you know, essentially saying that, you know, under OMB policy, Office of Management Budget Policy, the pool can be up to 5%. So that obviously 1% is a little bit below that. And in addition, the Defense Department is saying that any bonuses over $25,000 for senior professionals will have to get White House approval. And that only those in both categories, only employees who score five, get a five on their performance evaluation, you know, essentially for excellent, outstanding performance, should be considered for awards. So this would presumably exclude a certain number of people from, you know, from consideration.
Yeah, it certainly would make Congress scrutinize the awards program more to see if more people are getting fives as a way to get around that.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, in general, I don't know what the situation is at DOD, but I think past research has shown that a lot of employees do rank up, you know, do score up at the top. So it's not clear how many people would be excluded from bonuses because of this requirement. But, you know, I think it's additional indication going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago about the continuing financial straits that are on the government. And as Ms. Bonacero pointed out, I mean, DSEA, senior executives, senior professionals don't get the same kind of longevity increases that people covered by the general schedule do. So these types of performance awards tend to be more important to their overall compensation.
Speaking of ceilings and raises, when the one percentage pay raise goes into effect, what, if anything, does that do to the GS ceiling?
I assume it would. That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I assume it would push it up a little bit since it's across the board. But
I was told that it would. It was going to remain at 155, whatever the figure is now. So that would push more people up against the ceiling, but that nobody at the top would be getting raises.
That's an excellent question.
Yeah, I wonder if you guys have looked at this. One of the provisions in the budget deal is for a self plus one health insurance plan. Now, the people have fought for that for years, and the government said, no, it's going to be self-only or family, and it doesn't matter whether your family is two people or 26, because the people with more kids, with bigger families, obviously pay more in medical bills and whatnot, but the premiums are the same no matter how large or small your family is. So there's a big push for this self plus one. Somebody told me it was because of the same-sex couples that are now a part of the government program.
I'm not sure. I mean, my understanding was this was something the Obama administration wanted, and would provide some, presumably be a better deal for. It would certainly apply to a lot of same-sex couples, I assume. Also, couples without children or without children getting coverage through the plan, and it would presumably provide them with a better deal than they would get under the typical family plan. I noticed the American Federation of Government Employees, which came out with a statement last night saying that, it rejects the deal because they don't like the increases pension increases even for new federal employees, despite the fact the current workforce wouldn't be affected. But they also objected to this self plus one option, saying it would push up costs for federal employees and retirees covered by the family plan.
I've heard it both ways, and at one point somebody said it would be a wash, it wouldn't matter, and others have said that the government actuaries who looked at it said this would cost, it's going to cost somebody, and it probably would be to the detriment of larger families.
Well, I have to see exactly how it breaks out. I don't know if OPM or the Office of Personnel Management has statistics on the potential number of employees who would take this option. I suspect it's something for the actuaries to work out.
Yeah, well, I know during the open season we've heard from a lot of couples, with just husband, wife, or spouse and spouse, and they said they were going to take two single plans to save money because the two single premiums were lower than a family plan, until Walton Francis and others pointed out that if you do that, you have two deductibles to hit. So this may be a way around that.
Good point. Yeah, and probably it could help in that regard.
Jen, listen, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you, Lauren Larson, for working the machinery here. And we'll see you all next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week and be safe.
Thanks, Mike.